This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. John Pierce's superpower is the ability to create a vision for the future, articulate it, and inspire others around it. In other words, he was born to run a startup. When he got to college, it didn't take John long to find a part-time internship with a Minneapolis startup, Provation Medical. He liked it so much that he stayed for more than 5 years until Provation was acquired. Soon after, John co-founded Zipgnosis, a Minneapolis telehealth platform provider that raised nearly $25 million and grew to 70 employees. Zipgnosis was acquired in 2021 for an undisclosed amount by Bright Health, a Minneapolis provider of health insurance and other healthcare services. John, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You grew up in Kansas, but went to college at St. Olaf in Minnesota, where you studied computer science and Russian. Your interest in startups was kindled during this internship at Provation Medical. Tell us about that.
It was a really transformative time for me. So Provation was a healthcare software company, and what they had done was sort of automate the dictation process that a physician would go through. So for example, if you went into for a colonoscopy, prior to Provation, the doctor would go in, they would do the colonoscopy, then they'd pick up a phone and literally just dictate, you know, here's what I did and here's what I saw. And then that information would be coded and reimbursed, and that's how the doctors get paid. Well, at Provation, we built software that allowed that physician to not have to pick up the phone and talk, and did all the coding and reimbursement for the physician. It was really complicated, it was really cool. And that really got me inserted directly into the startup ecosystem. It was around the dot-com bubble before everything kind of blew up. And it was really inspiring for me. Met a lot of really interesting people, smart people. And although I had no interest in healthcare, kind of became hooked with the problems that we were solving. And certainly, again, the people that I was interacting with was really fun.
Well, I assume you got in because of your computer science abilities. Did you stick with coding and that sort of thing, or do other things at Provation?
Yeah, I was mostly coding. I like to joke, so I have a degree in Russian language and computer science, and I can't speak Russian and I can't code. So, you know, we'll talk about the career journeys around that. But, you know, I was able to do just enough damage to continue on in a technical role there. So after the internship, they basically offered me a job and said, hey, drop out of school and come work with us. And I said, oh, I can't. I had written my own study abroad program to go study in Russia as a part of my major. And I said, I got to go graduate and I got to go do that. And a good thing I did, because, you know, the bubble burst and they definitely went through a downturn. But after I graduated, I ended up back there coding for them for a little while.
One of the things about that job, though, was that you got to interact with some of the doctors that were dealing with Provation, right?
Yeah. So I'm a technical guy, right? And within, you know, the first 2 weeks, they're like, John, we want you to go out to Colorado into this orthopedic clinic, because they were launching an orthopedic product at that time. And I said, okay, you know, I like Colorado. And I flew out there, and you know, I'm 22 years old. I have no clinical background. This is my first real job. And I show up at the clinic and, you know, they think I know what I'm doing and I have no clue. And they say, all right, the changing room's over there. You can get your scrubs on. And I'm like, my what? Like, I don't know what this means. So, you know, I don't know what I'm putting the scrubs on. I'm putting the booties on, and I'm standing kind of in the corridor outside of the operating room. Right. And they're bringing the patient in, and, you know, this is orthopedics. This is, you know, human carpentry. And they're like, we need the Provation guy to come in and help us with a technical issue. And I about passed out. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Because there's this knee that's like open right there and they're working on it. And that was kind of trial by fire of getting to work with the physicians. But it was good. One of the things I learned, and this is, I think, where my language skills came into play there, was the physicians really, because I didn't have a clinical background, really didn't give me a lot of their time, right? So I would study the orthopedic handbook as I flew back and forth from Colorado to Minneapolis, and I learned the language, and that really got me, I think, a lot more interested in healthcare, and certainly got me over sort of a credibility hump with a lot of these orthopedic surgeons. And you know, by the time I was done at probation, you know, I was just shooting breeze with the doctors in the operating room and felt very comfortable in that setting.
So you held back on us. You speak three languages, computer science, Russian, and orthopedic.
Yeah. Yeah, but don't pay me to do any procedures.
Provation was acquired in 2006 by Wolters Kluwer. You weren't real interested in the corporate life, so you went back to graduate school for an MBA. You had maybe the lowest GPA in your class. How come?
Yeah, because I'm not the brightest ball, but I turn on every time. That's another one of the things I've learned about myself. You know, I used business school, honestly, to just incubate Zipgnosis, really. So I learned a lot at probation, you know, had a technical foundation, had the clinical foundation, but really had very little exposure to the financing side of running a business and certainly raising capital. And that was a big part of going to Carlson, where I used, you know, cheap student loans to just kind of live and learn. And I spent a lot of time taking every single entrepreneurship class, financing class. And then, you know, I didn't study. I worked on building Zip. And I have all the debt and none of the degree. I actually dropped out about 2/3 of the way through. But, you know, it was the right move ultimately.
You co-founded Zipgnosis in 2008, well before the world was ready for telehealth and virtual visits and all that stuff. A few people signed up and then nothing. What'd you do?
We lived and died a lot. You know, it was the right idea, the wrong decade, right? In hindsight, what we built really worked, and that was part of the problem. So a big part of what Zipgnosis did, we were there to sort of transform how and where patients and providers connected for care. And for me, one of the insights I had at probation was that the cell phone was going to be sort of the clinic of the future. And I wanted to go build a new way of connecting patients and providers on that, and not just sort of recreate a lot of the bad things that were happening in face-to-face care. So we built a really smart, you know, computer system behind it to do a lot of the intake and triage for the patient. So as a consumer, you would log into the Zipgnosis website, and instead of talking directly with the provider, you'd answer a series of software guided questions, like a little interview. And from that, then we would package up all that information and send it to a provider who in under 2 minutes could review it and make a highly accurate diagnosis and give you a script if needed. So it was really, really efficient. It was simple for patients. We charged $25 at first direct to consumer. And of course it saved, you know, clinicians a ton of time, which is horrible. And none of that is what healthcare wanted, right? They want to continue to have high prices. They want to continue to sort of gate the access to care. And so everything about that process worked beautifully for the pretty much the entire duration of Zipgnosis. But what really wasn't there was the business case. How do you build a good, profitable business out of it? And so we started as MinuteClinic on the iPhone, as you mentioned, going direct to consumer, and kind of, you know, pivoted a number of different directions, and ultimately had a health system call us, Fairview, up here in the Twin Cities and say, hey, we don't want the Zip brand necessarily, but we want the software. Can we license it from you? And they paid us. And that started sort of the path to actually building a good business, where we ultimately just became a SaaS provider to healthcare systems.
SaaS being software as a service, right?
Yes.
So you started out thinking you were going to sell directly to the patients, and then you realized when Fairview called you that you'd be better off like white gloving your product for providers, right?
And, you know, again, it's not some startling insight, you know, that I had. It was just pragmatic, right? They were willing to pay us, and we worked with them, you know, for probably about 2 years just to kind of update everything so that we could really integrate deeply within their technology and then also their provider system. And then we had an article published by the advisory board, and it wasn't a very big one, but a woman down at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, saw it and called us out of the blue and said, hey, we want to license this too. And that was kind of the, you know, that really started the path again towards, hey, I think we can be a provider and build a really good business around licensing it to health systems. But going direct to consumer, we learned a lot. I don't think that was the wrong move. We certainly learned a ton about the service, how, you know, patients interact with it. And that was really useful through the years.
Let me follow up on that. I assume you're not talking about virtual visits for heart attacks. You know, what kinds of health issues would people use Zipgnosis for?
These are really simple, sort of common problems. So sinus infection, bladder infection, acne, really kind of simple things. And generally, we followed what the retail clinics like MinuteClinic had done, where we're not trying to do chronic disease. We're not treating really, really sick patients with a lot of comorbidities. this is just kind of for that routine care that you can get just super simple.
So wouldn't you run into, though, I know, like, you know, I call the doctor and say, I have a sore throat. And they say, well, you have to come in because we have to do a strep test. You know, don't you run into that kind of stuff?
Yeah, all the time. And actually, it's interesting. So strep was a big issue for us. And one of the things we did was we actually built a boarding pass called the Zip Ticket that really, especially during COVID later on, became really powerful. But that would allow you to do a virtual visit with us and then basically give you a fast pass into the clinic if you needed a particular lab. So strep was one of the places where we had to sort of innovate. One of the things that I've learned as an entrepreneur is that constraints are where innovation happens, right? Every business, everything has time constraints, money constraints, et cetera. And for us, being able to effectively treat patients and give them a satisfactory and good clinical experience meant that we had to figure out how we connected that virtual into the clinic setting. And that was a part of how we addressed that.
You mentioned the pandemic. That must have helped your business.
Yeah, it was the best thing, best marketing for telemedicine ever. it was transformative. And I don't mean to be glib. It was a very intense time. You know, we went from doing, you know, 1700 visits to, you know, almost 60,000 overnight. It was an unbelievable trajectory for us. And there was a period there where, and we were only about 32 people when the pandemic had, we had, you know, really run in pretty lean, and we became one of the highest volume platforms in the country. We were treating hundreds of thousands of patients, you know, every 24 or 48 hours. And it was really cool for me and the team, because our approach to telemedicine using, you know, this computer aided way of getting information was, you know, kind of the outlier, even within telemedicine, and it worked beautifully. It scaled flawlessly. We were able to very quickly update guidelines, you know, as COVID spread. You know, we could talk to the providers out in Seattle and they could help, you know, the providers in Texas. And it was really validating for me. And then again, the team that had worked very, very hard to build something unique, to see it actually work at scale at the time of need. And that was really powerful.
Talk about right place, right time, huh?
Yeah, just 10 years in the making, right?
Well, I wanted to ask, you were early with this technology and with the whole idea of telehealth. And I've seen a lot of startups fail because they were too early, right idea, but too early. How did you deal with that? How did you manage that situation and get through it?
You know, it was tough, and it required a lot of sacrifice and tenacity, and also, you know, having good people around me. At the end of the day, I really felt like this had to happen. It was inevitable, and there was something sort of deep within me that really felt that it was working. You could see it work. You could see the satisfaction in patients. You could see the economics behind it actually manifesting. And we just needed to get some traction, right? We just needed a little bit of commercial success to see it live on. And that was motivating. And there were definitely very, very lean times, you know, where certainly I wasn't getting paid and it's 24-hour support. But it was definitely sort of that tenacity and drive that kept me going. And then, you know, the handful of people who worked with me through that too. I certainly wasn't alone on that. And, you know, that's necessary to make it through the desert.
It's been a pleasure talking to you about it, John. And you're young. It's going to be fun to watch what you do next.
Well, thank you very much.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Valerie King Bailey earned her undergraduate degree in civil and environmental engineering and got a job at U.S. Steel Corp. when that plant shut down in 1983. A serendipitous conversation with an advisor connected Valerie with a job in the rapidly growing software industry. Three software startups and two large companies later, She finally, in 2004, founded a company of her own, Chicago-based Onshore Technology Group, which does software quality control, has 13 employees and more than 200 clients. It made the 2021 Inc. 5000 list of fastest-growing companies and raised its first outside investment dollars in 2020. Valerie, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
It's good to be with you.
Your father was a bricklayer and your mother worked in a dress shop, so you came to rely on advisors to help you map out your business career. It was an advisor, in fact, who made you realize you wanted to work toward owning your own business. Tell us about how that happened.
Yes, my academic advisor at the University of Wisconsin was the first individual to put the bug in my ear about entrepreneurship. I had come to him at the end of the semester when I was leaving Madison, and it was just kind of a final interview. And he asked me, what do you see yourself doing in the future, maybe 5 years, 10 years down the line? And I said, I really would like to own my own business. And he said, oh, that's great, because I was asking also at the same time, what should be the next step in terms of my academic career? Should I get a graduate degree in engineering, or should I get a graduate degree in business? And he said, if your next objective is to own your own business, then go ahead and get an MBA. And that's what started me on my journey to entrepreneurship. I got my MBA in information systems in 1985 from Keller Graduate School of Management. And I would say that is the best advice I have ever been given.
Well, you know, it was a long route to doing your startup. You had various high-level roles at three software startups that have grown considerably, Intergraph, Documentum, and Quamus. You learned about software quality control, which also is called verification and validation testing. You learned about that at all of them. What did you learn about startups while you were at these growing startups?
And that's interesting, because I have a unique experience that many people don't get. I saw three startup companies start from ground zero and grow into billion-dollar corporations. And there are a lot of lessons that you can learn. Let me give you the five lessons that I learned. Number one, cash is king. In all of the companies that I've been in, there's an old saying, revenue is vanity, but profit is sanity. You really have to focus on cash is king, because many startup businesses fail before the first 5 years. And one of the reasons is that they don't understand how to generate cash. That was the first thing that I learned. And when I started Onshore, the first thing I did was make sure that I had a revenue generating machine and that I was able to generate cash pretty much day one. The second thing that I learned, and it's been a principle that I've guided my life with, is perseverance. A lot of people give up. You know, you see entrepreneurs and, you know, it kind of looks glamorous if you look on the outside. Ooh, you've got a title of CEO. Oh, you sit in a corner office. Well, some of us do anyway. You have all of the perks of a CEO, but there's a lot of hard work that goes into being a CEO, but it's rewarding. So I would always tell people, persevere, never quit. This is worth it, and especially for women, because we get into entrepreneurship in businesses for different reasons. Some people get in and they're serial entrepreneurs, but women get in because it is a path to economic freedom. And that's what it means for a lot, not only of women, but a lot of minority companies. We don't get into it for the glamour of it. This is our life.
Before we get to number three, I just want to jump in. You know, talking about perseverance, When you got a job at Abbott Labs at one point, and you know, it was a big job, you had a tight deadline, you went on to win the Abbott Chairman's Award 2 years in a row, but when you started, one of the other executives said to you that he didn't think you could get your that job done. He didn't think you could get that software system validated in the timeline you had. How did you process that feedback? This is about perseverance, right?
Absolutely. It's about perseverance, but it's about accepting the challenge. The way I took that is I took that as a challenge. Some people may have been a bit insulted by that because it could imply that you can't get the job done. I didn't take it like that at all. I took it as a challenge because I knew I could do it. And this gets to, as you say, the whole notion of perseverance and never quit. I was on a mission at that time to prove to him that I could get it done.
Okay, how about number three that you learned at all those startups?
Yeah, number three was always deliver. And this kind of piggybacks onto my experience at Abbott. I was determined to deliver for my new boss. And I wanted him to see that you didn't make a mistake here with me. I can deliver and I can do what I said I could do during my job interview. So always deliver. The fourth one is quality and customer service matters. Be relentless about customer service if you're a startup, because you're only as good as your references are. And if you get a reputation early that, you know, you're not focusing on the quality of your work and customer service, you'll be out of business very fast. And then the last one is employees are your greatest assets. The most successful companies that I have ever been working with or affiliated with take their employees seriously. Some organizations, which will remain nameless and faceless, they use or abuse their employees. Your greatest asset walks out of the door every single night. So I've learned to really respect and work with my employees. I don't like to even say, you know, this person works for me or this person works for me. I always like to say that they work with me, because no one can run a company by themselves. So treat your employees as if they are king.
So we've now established you, through your career, got all the qualities you needed to run a startup. And 20-some years after you told your advisor that you wanted to do a startup, you did one. You did Onshore Technology Group. You bootstrapped it for a long time. But in 2020, you raised an undisclosed amount of venture capital funding that you've used to integrate artificial intelligence into your products. Raising venture capital isn't common for Black women. Tell us about how you went into that.
Yes, very interesting. We have developed our software application, Validation Master. And Validation Master was gaining a beachhead in the market. And I realized very quickly I was going to need venture capital. Now, the statistics around venture capital are not friendly to women, but are even less friendly to Black women. Only 2.7% of all venture capital went to female founders in 2019. And that's been pretty consistent over the last 10 years. But for Black women, there were only 34 Black women founders in 2018 that had ever raised over $1 million in capital. And $1 million is kind of like, that's the marker, if you will. In 2020, that tripled into 93 Black women that reported getting over $1 million. So in 2021, I was the 99th Black woman to actually exceed $1 million in investor funding or venture funding. And that's not in Illinois, that's across the entire United States of America. 99 Black women getting over $1 million in VC funding. That has got to change, because one of the things, and there are many, many Black women running successful businesses, making money and that kind of thing. We just don't, for a variety of different reasons, get the ear of venture capital. And some of us really don't even apply, to be quite frank, because of the rejection rate. But that's something that's going to have to change, because Black women particularly need to raise scalable enterprises that can scale beyond a one-person, two-person firm. That was my objective, and we actually met and exceeded that objective.
Have you noticed, I'm assuming you have from your comments, that female entrepreneurs are held to a different standard when raising venture capital?
Indeed, indeed. When I spoke to some venture capitalists early in my career, they were insisting that I be profitable. At that time, one even asked me the question. They said, well, if you're doing this great, why aren't you profitable? Well, actually, I was. Onshore has been profitable since year one, and we've never had a year where we actually lost money. But it was interesting that, some of the larger players in the market were not asked about their profitability. If you remember the whole dot-com era, where there was a dot-com boom and a dot-com bust, one of the reasons for the dot-com bust is that venture capitalists took the word of mostly male founders, and they invested billions and billions and billions of dollars. These people had not made a penny or proved that they could make a penny. But when they interview women, female founders, there is a little bit of a different standard. It's a little bit more stringent of a process for us to get funding. And again, we have to get past that because, if you look at the statistics of women-owned businesses, there was a study that was done recently where women-owned businesses are actually more profitable than their male counterparts. So I think venture capitalists may be missing a huge area in terms of a group of businesses led by women that could increase the value of their portfolios.
Well, Valerie, I think I have the solution. What you need to do is scale your company, do an initial public offering, and take the proceeds and start a venture capital firm.
That is actually quiet as it's kept. That's something that has been stirring in my mind, because we have to open up venture capital to a broader audience, and all kinds of women, Black women, women of all backgrounds and stripes, we all deserve an opportunity to realize the American dream. And it's not just a group of men, but women now are finding their own place in business. And I would say to that, it's about time.
Not going to argue with you on that. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and we'll keep an eye out on you.
You are very welcome. It's good to be with you today. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me, and today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for listening to our first season of Midwest Moxie on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Remember, you can subscribe and listen to hear all of our episodes on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.